Okay, very good. So, Ayachandra, why did you want to become a bhikkhuni? And why did you want to run away into solitude? Were you trying to escape from something?
It's an interesting question because I noticed in the introduction that Yonando, is that right? Yon? Yon? I'm not good with my Norwegian vowels, but you said that I decided to become bhikkhuni in 2014. But actually, something in me decided to renounce, or just had the inclination to renounce, many, many years before. And it brings up the question of how much is really free will? How much is really my choice? How much is something that I'm carrying with me, like an inclination or even an intuition that maybe some happiness can be found in actually letting go and in trying to live a life of contentment rather than a life of accumulation and a life of like stimulating the senses and always looking for more and more and more. So it was actually only in 2014, after how many years of practice? A lot. So I started in 96. That the opportunity arose to take the full ordination. And I remember that at that time I was thinking of going to Santi Monastery. Oh, you were kind of encouraging me. You've always encouraged me into a leadership role that I don't feel ready for. And I still don't feel ready for.
It's called brainwashing.
It's called brainwashing.
And I'm very good at brainwashing.
Yeah. And the thing is, you don't know how much is the brainwashing and how much is your own idea. But it was actually you that asked me.
Yeah.
When I finally decided to go to Santi, I said, okay, I've decided, I made my decision, I'll do what you want. You said, actually, stay in Perth and take bhikkhuni ordination.
Yeah.
So I didn't choose it. I actually renounced a lot sooner than that, a long time before that, and said, okay, I give my life to the Dhamma, and let's see where that leads.
So whose fault was it?
The Buddha's fault.
I thought she was going to say, your fault, actually. Well, you told me what to do it.
You know that sometimes I always think like that too. If something happens and it doesn't go the way I want it to, but it never does. It goes always in a much more interesting way than I ever thought. Who would have ever thought that because of saying you should become a bhikkhuni in Australia, you ended up giving a talk here in Oslo? Very, very unlikely. But that's one of the nice things I always think about life. You never know where it's going to go next. And just to enjoy the journey and see what happens. You can always make something out of it. But one of the things I do always object to is when we blame people. You blame this person or that person. And sometimes we're all subject to our conditioning, our brainwashing. And the job is not to blame anybody, but just to forgive and to learn and to grow. And I always find that's a much more peaceful way. So, over those years, what have you learned? Nothing. I remember one of these time marks when he was interviewed by, I think it was an Irish TV show. He said, all these years you've been a monk, what have you learned? And he said, I've learned how to mix concrete. Because in those days we had to build our own monasteries. Do you know how to make concrete?
Not yet.
Okay, so anyway, what about the idea of blaming? Because sometimes people blame you.
Oh yeah, they blame you too.
Yeah, why do they blame you when you're a woman who decides what you want to do, and it's a beautiful thing you're doing? Is it a good thing she's doing?
Oh yeah.
So would you like her to give in to some traditions who say you should not be a bhikkhuni in today's world? Is that right?
No.
No, I agree with you. But anyway, so how do you respond to such things?
Well, first of all, I think I'm trying not to get inside the heads of people, of other people, and why they blame women and what it is that the monks have a problem with, because this is a completely endless and futile line of questioning. Because they too are conditioned, right? They also have their beliefs that are inbuilt through the way they've been brought up, through the school, through the tradition that they're in. And I always think it's dangerous to talk about they, you know? I never like to think about people in terms of a group, because we're all individuals And it's just such a waste of energy to try and understand what others are doing and where they're coming from. And to kind of measure our own quality of life or our own value by what others place upon us. Because they're just coming through their own perceptions, you know, their own conditioning. And it changes, even for one individual, it changes so many times during the day. You know, even my own mind, part of the day, I'm thinking, that's it, I'm not doing this anymore. Why is I jumping from Sydney to Oxford? I didn't want to be in England. And then the next moment, I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is such an amazing, inspiring project. It's bringing benefit to so many people. So which is the right way of thinking? And I think eventually, you know, it's a question of looking inward to find, what do I really value in my life? You know, is it being praised, being avoiding blame? Is it wealth? Is it, you know, kind of beauty? Or is it something else inside that's, you know, causing us a real depth of contentment? So I try to just live in line with my own understanding of ethics, my own integrity, and ask myself, is this coming from a place of wanting to cause benefit to others? Is it, you know, helping me grow in wholesome states like compassion, letting go, humility? Or is it leading in the other direction? So I think this is a much more reliable and ethical, wholesome way to measure oneself, if one has to do that at all.
Do you ever blame anybody?
Sometimes I blame you. When it's not going well.
It's not going well.
But when it's going well, that's my fault.
Yeah. No, it's never anybody's fault.
I'm just kidding.
This is one of the interesting things about life. Sometimes, you know, somebody blames you. You ask them, who are you blaming? What are you blaming? Sometimes I was brainwashed very heavily by an Ajahn Chah. So I say, well, if you want to blame anyone, blame my teacher. Honestly, when it comes to bad jokes even, it's not my fault that I say bad jokes, because that's what my father used to say. And just, I think, over in UK recently, I said the story of when my father came home one day and he said, oh, it's terrible news, one of his friends had an accident and he lost his leg. Yeah. And went into the hospital, and they had to amputate the leg, and then they found out that they'd amputated the wrong leg. So I had to go straight back into surgery and amputate the other leg. And then as soon as he could, he took the hospital to court, he sued them, but he lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. So you're going to blame me for that one? That's what my father told me when I was young. And so sometimes you see people's quirkiness, and that's what I'm known as, you know, to Sir Michael can tell some funny stories or some bad jokes. But you know that, if you didn't know that, you didn't do your research before you came in here. And it's just, that's how you grow up. And you can't really get upset when you know that this is just who you are. And you're at peace with who you are. And you tell a funny story, which I hope was funny, and just to give some happiness and joy to people. It's not a true story, obviously. It's all made up.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question, Ajahn?
No.
Based on... Okay, I do it anyway, because I'm conditioned to ask anyway.
Yeah.
But based on what you just said about blame and about doing things and understanding that it's not your fault and that you're conditioned a certain way, how did you feel when your friends for so many years in monastic life, people you'd ordained with, basically tried to tell you that you're no longer their friend? And you're no longer allowed to be associated with their monasteries in Thailand. Did you blame them?
No, because that was after the ordination of the bhikkhunis, the first four bhikkhunis. And when that actually happened, like many things in life, you have a choice. And you can take the easy way, which is not the the moral way, the way of integrity, and just say, okay, no, we're not doing that. Those four women, I knew them. They were really good women. They'd already did a pre-ordination has a 10-precept nun. When they came up and said they wanted to take the full ordination, it was, why not? This wasn't just an idea to make a protest or to make a difference in the sense of some overarching philosophy. This was real women who I knew very well, and they wanted to become bhikkhunis. And of course, the answer was, why not? So for others, I mean, some of the people who did not agree with me, they hadn't even seen such women before. They hadn't seen people who wanted to become bhikkhunis. So when you actually see it, and there's a possibility of doing it, of course you do it. And the consequences, yeah, these were some of my friends. And honestly, I'm not making this up, they're still my friends. I still care for them. I wish them well. And even some that I haven't seen for a long time. But nevertheless, you know, they are also in the prison of some of their cultural biases. It's an important thing, if ever you are a leader, and then you sit on a chair like this, make sure that sometimes you sit in the back as well, so you don't isolate yourself by the fact that people respect you too much. You do need to physically and intentionally make contact with others so that you're not just conditioned by your immediate group of friends. It's one of the reasons why I know that this has happened here in Oslo. Whenever you take me anywhere, you always take me in a car. Sometimes the police let us use the public transport. And that's what happened. When in London, I know the public transport there so well, and I've got like an Oyster card, so I don't need money. You can just get on the underground any place. There's some wonderful experiences on the underground. And this one time, this lady came and sat next to me and said to me, said, "Are you a Buddhist monk?" I said, "Yes." "A real monk?" "Yes." And then she started asking. She wanted to understand something about Buddhism. So that's when I started talking a little bit about Buddhism. What about reincarnation? So that's very interesting, because recently there was an Italian man at our retreat center in Perth, and during his meditations he had these very strange visions. The first vision, he saw himself as a piece of spaghetti, which was weird. Then the next time he saw himself as a piece of macaroni. And then I got it. I don't know, do you understand what he was doing? It's very, very simple. He was Italian. He was remembering his past lives. And when I said that, it was an underground train in UK, pretty full, and all the people were looking at their iPhones, suddenly looked up, half of them groaned, some of them laughed, but at least I made contact with these people in this train, who usually just keep their own little bubble. So that's one of the reasons why it's nice to get out there and get some feedback and give some feedback to others.
Yeah. So is that ability of yours, that desire of yours to like be approachable and to integrate and to get to listen to different perspectives, is that part of what conditioned you to be open to the bhikkhuni ordination?
Certainly. Yeah. Look, what's the problem? I often ask. If a woman wants to have that full ordination as a bhikkhuni, it was allowed by the Buddha in the very earliest of times. And it was even the mission of the Buddha. He said that's why after he became enlightened, he decided to establish the equity amongst the monastic community, the monks, the nuns, the laymen and the laywomen. Don't let's say he was ahead of his time. You can't say fairness, equity, logic is ahead of any time or behind any time. It's there for everybody. It should be there all the time. Really, why not? So that's what the Buddha wanted, and it was possible. the thing was that, you know, as a Buddhist monk, you know, I'd had a good education. I was fortunate. You don't think yourself any better because you have a good education. But nevertheless, that gives you a brain which you can make use of, you know, to learn, you know, the original language of, you know, the Buddha's Theravada teachings, Pali, and to know that Vinaya, and to see that there was no obstacle for women becoming fully ordained. And if you ever, if anybody says that there cannot be any bhikkhunis in Norway or anywhere in the world, you can ask them why. And there's no ground to that at all. It's one of these things, just political, or not so much political, but cultural blockage, which is one of the reasons why that Venerable Bhikkhuni may be the only bhikkhuni in England at the moment, and the only bhikkhuni in Norway today.
Ever?
Ever. No bhikkhunis here ever before. Wow.
Wow, and also, wow, that's difficult.
Yeah.
To be so marginalised, right? And not to have community.
Yeah, so how do we overcome the marginalisation?
Is that bad karma?
No, how do we overcome it? Just over the years. We're not asking anybody here to, you know, to shave off your hair and become a bhikkhuni, but sometimes people want to do that. You know that when we first started a bhikkhuni monastery over in Western Australia, this gentleman came to see me. I hadn't seen him before. And he said his wife had just given birth to their first child. The first child in their family. And it happened to be a daughter. And he said that, no, he wasn't one to ever be a monastic, but he said that his daughter, who knows, might one day want to become a bhikkhuni, a nun. And so he said, if she ever wants to, I want that to be possible for her. And so he handed over a $250,000 check. I'm usually very peaceful, but honestly, I was shaking it. And it was just out of the blue, those sorts of things happened. Because sometimes, you know, for fairness and equity, and you can actually see that it's going to be something which is worthwhile. It's, okay, sometimes you think I overestimate this, but it is historic. Over 2,500 years of Buddhism, the bhikkhuni sangha disappeared in some places. It remained in other places. And now we're living in a time where it's coming back again. And I don't know about you, maybe I just overestimate this, but I think it's really amazingly historic. All the things are in place there. You know, the arguments, the moral arguments, the textual arguments. Now it's just getting the people together and making it happen. This is history. Is it working?
Yes, it is working.
Okay, yeah.
I was just thinking to see if anyone has any questions. Just also sometimes just raise your hands. I'm watching over and then I'll come running. We can also interrupt.
Yeah. And they can be about anything.
Yeah.
Roughly related, but it doesn't have to be specific. Whatever you want to share or ask or question is on, because you might not agree, and that's okay too.
Do you think that solitude was good, 6 months? In solitude? Put your hands up if you think it's a good idea to put your wife in 6 months of solitude. I didn't put the question properly, so. Would you like to do 6 months of solitude? No, seriously. Do you think that's a good idea? Yeah. Oh, yeah, you want to do it.
Ellen has a question.
Yeah. No, he said he wants to do 6 months.
Oh, you want to do it? Okay, yeah. Super. Ajahn, you also did 6 months of solitude.
Yeah.
Can I turn the tables on you?
Yes, certainly.
Because I'm wondering how that helped, that depth of practice, when this thing did fall out about bhikkhunis. Like, how did you actually cope with that? Did your practice help, or did it shake.
No, it's just, this is one of the reasons why, you know, the word monk, you know, means like someone who's alone for a while. Alone but not lonely. To get that time to really get to know, you know, how you work. One of the things is that people ask me after I emerged from a 6-month retreat, that was maybe 20, 30 years ago now.
20.
And they asked, you know, how were you? Were you lonely? Did you miss things? And of course the answer was no, because I was always with my best friend, which was me. You learned about yourself, and you accepted yourself, you're at peace with yourself, you forgave yourself. I never blamed myself for anything. And at the same time, being alone and happy and meditating there, you soon became very sensitive to the animals around you. And those animals around you, there were snakes, very big ones. I remember this very dangerous snake coming up, right up to me. And then I was washing my bowl, so I looked at it and then turned around. It could have bitten me so easily, but I wasn't interested. I was not going to harm the snake. The snake, of course, never harmed me, but just turned around. All it wanted was some shade of the hut where I was living in. So he just shaded itself under the wall, and I finished my bowl, and then I went one way, he went the other way. Actually, I don't know if it was a he. I never checked up.
It was in a monk's monastery.
Yes, a monk's monastery, yes, but we accept everybody. And many female kangaroos there.
Mm.
But anyway, it gave you a lot of sensitivity to the life around you. One of the things I would always delight in was the memory of these two eagles who would come out at a certain time in the afternoon with their young, teaching them how to fly. And because, you know, I had total solitude, I had no schedules or duties at all. So I roughly knew when those eagles would take their young out, and I would always be watching them. It was delightful to see them. They weren't afraid of me. Of course, I wasn't afraid of them, but it was beautiful to see nature in the raw, being a solitary observer. So there's many, many things in solitude, especially the nature around you, become far more sensitive to than your ordinary world where you have to work hard.
Yeah.
And it gave me a lot of wisdom. And also, when you have a foundation in your spirituality, it doesn't matter what other people say to you. They can say all sorts of things that, you know, you shouldn't have done that, you should have consulted more. One of the things I notice when you take the lead and do something controversial, many people are quick to criticize.
Mm-hmm.
And much of the time what they criticize you for is actually not true. They're just wanting to find an excuse not to join in because of some pressure in the place they are living in. But when you have a foundation in spirituality, that gives you the strength to endure anything. The peace and the stillness inside gives you the clarity to know what you're doing is correct. As we used to say, we're on the right side of history.
Yeah, and for me, I think having the solitude and being able to really go deep inside also helps me to see that if something difficult happens on the outside, that's not actually the problem. You know, even if I feel bad about it or I feel like anxious about it, the issue is my response. So if I stop kind of measuring my life in terms of pleasant feeling and actually instead start to measure it by inner integrity, then it's not so important. You know, whether you feel kind of nervous about something or fear, we don't measure things that way. You know, it's that idea of feel the fear and do it anyway. It's like, it's brave to feel fear. Like, you don't have to feel that it's like wrong or shouldn't be there or that it's a sign of weakness. Actually, through the meditation, you learn to be able to embrace all of those emotions. And like you said, Ajahn, it was an opportunity to really make friends with myself. Like, you can't be alone with yourself for that length of time unless you have a very good relationship with your body and mind, and also with your breath. You know, so sometimes people think, wow, 6 months of solitude, maybe it's just pure bliss. And I think for some people it might well be. For me, I'm not at that point on the path. But my practice is really much more about making peace with everything that arises and learning to be genuinely kind and embrace and accept everything that arises as a kind of way to understand myself and then develop more empathy with others too. So it was quite cute really, because sometimes I'd be maybe having a difficult day and then I'd go outside and there'd be a little ant or a lizard and I'd find myself calling it sweetheart, you know, oh sweetheart, how are you doing? And kind of giving names to all the kangaroos, so I have my little kangaroo families. And at some point in that retreat, when I started putting food out for the magpies, there was a place that I also put food under a tree. And when the sun started to come out, it was quite a cold winter, but I don't know, September time, it got a bit warmer. And then there were these beautiful blue tongue lizards that used to kind of hang out where I put the food. And then it only took them a couple of days before they started coming up to my door and actually kind of knocking on the door, putting their little face there, and I could hear this choo-choo-choo. And then I'd go out and these little lizards were there. One day they came in through the back door, so I opened it, and there they were, lined up, two lizards. So I think one of the most beautiful things, you know, about befriending yourself in retreat is that you become like a kind of... you become harmless, and other beings pick that up. You know, they can tell that this is a being that's, yeah, not going to harm, that doesn't want to exploit, that doesn't want to hurt us in any way. And it's just so beautiful to feel integrated and one with nature like that. So far from being alone, I actually feel that it gives me a much deeper connection to other creatures and beings around, even to the point of like maybe invisible beings, right? Because we always think that what we see with our senses is all that exists. But after some time, you know, sometimes you feel a very strong positive energy. And Ajahn Brahm used to come down to my kuti with a chaperone and give me an interview from time to time. And you could feel the energy in that hut. And also he would supercharge it up from time to time, which was wonderful.
Look, I'm a theoretical physicist.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't sort of imagine these things, but in my life as a Buddhist monk, 48 years, I've seen so much weird stuff. And you know, there are, I want to say this, you don't have to believe it, there are these, you know, heavenly beings who can help and look after you.
When you say that you are alone with yourself, what do you mean? Do you mean with your own soul or with your own body?
I mean, of course, until we understand what the self is or is not, we use this word as in a conventional way. So when I'm talking about being alone with myself, I'm talking about being physically secluded from others. So that means that I'm in a hut in the forest. And yes, there are kangaroos, but I'm not usually speaking to them. Sometimes I found myself speaking to them. I thought, maybe I'm going a bit mad. But I'm talking about the physical seclusion. So I actually took myself away from the main community. And my food was kind of put every day in this little box on the hillside. So I'd walk up and I wouldn't even see anyone. And then I'd return to my hut. So when I talk about making peace with myself, I'm talking about anything that arises in my experience. And of course, it's not my experience, but we just use those terms to describe something. So it doesn't matter what it is, you know, whether it's something that may be related to the past, whether it's anxiety or joy or peace or bliss, to make peace with all of that and to learn to treat it equally. Because real loving kindness is to embrace and accept everything impartially without preference. So that's the challenge, really, because, you know, we're complex, right? We have complex minds and bodies and emotions. So, yeah, all of that is plenty to observe.
Can I ask you a little question, Chanda?
Yeah.
So when you have spent this 6 months and then you return home, how do you sort of do that transition and how you bring with you all the goodness that
right.
you sort of attained during the retreat.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I have to qualify straight away that I actually didn't just come out of solitude, because the intention, again, it wasn't my fault, but the intention was to have a 6-month retreat. And actually, after about 4 months, the retreat that we'd organised for Ajahn Brahm in England, basically the retreat centre that was fully booked with 70 of our retreatants closed, or announced plans to close. So suddenly I went from being in like 12 hours meditation every day and complete solitude and lots of time to practice, literally overnight into the same amount of time online, trying to reorganise everything. So it was such a transition, there was no time to integrate anything. And it was actually because the senses become so peaceful and calm, you know, and you're used to very little input, to the point where even if I would have like a train of thoughts, I'd need extra sleep. You know, you become so sensitive and used to a very, very simple, quiet lifestyle that when I went online to do this service, my head literally was ringing. It was like hurting, you know, my whole body was hurting. But the way that I dealt with that was to recognize that even this service is part of the path. And although it might not feel nice, again, not judging my life by the feelings, but looking at the values that I'm trying to bring into the world. So it was a matter of bringing all that kindness into the way I served. And sometimes it meant being kind to my volunteers by staying online late. You know, sometimes it meant taking that extra bit of attention to make sure somebody gets a bursary space, you know, somebody who's maybe more disadvantaged or is going through financially hard times. So little things like that, you know, became a source of joy to a point, but then it was quite intense as well. So it's only really now that I'm kind of integrating the whole thing and coming back into society, if you like, meeting people, sharing a little bit of Dhamma. And I think results from retreats cannot be measured in terms of experience that you have on your cushion, but it has to be measured in how that translates in life. So, and there's no doubt it will. I have that confidence, you know, that if you make peace and if you develop these beautiful qualities, they will manifest, but we don't know when or really how. So
can I just follow up on that?
Sure.
In our everyday life, we are usually quite stressed and we have a lot of things to do, so what kind of training or what kind of attitude would you recommend for maintaining a good spirit?
Yeah, good question, and I'm still working on it. I have to be honest. Sometimes it's really too much. So again, I try to align what I'm doing with the Eightfold Path. I try to remind myself that if I'm, say, really, really busy serving, or in any livelihood, right, whatever livelihood you have, hopefully it's a good livelihood, you're not kind of creating poison or, I don't know, killing living beings or, you know, stealing from anyone, then remember this is part of right action. Yeah? And right action should be motivated by kindness, by letting go, not controlling things too much, you know, not owning what you do too much so that you become tight, and also being kind, being gentle with yourself. So if you can bring these motivations into what you do, then the results will be much better. And you can feel happiness that, okay, I'm practicing right action, I'm practicing maybe right speech, and this is going to like feed into the meditation as well. So the Buddha never said it's all about meditating only. You know, it was an Eightfold Path, and the meditation kind of comes later in that path. So they have to like feed into each other and reinforce each limb.
Also to follow up on that, because we are lay people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So especially now here in Oslo, in the West, spirituality is marginalized in a way. You could see that in the COVID time where like religion went in the very bottom of the list that was closed and there was not a priority. How, or do you have any tips, any ideas, advice on how we as that lay people can make it to our priority in the everyday? And we're also so far away from the where Buddhism started. We're on a different continent, right?
Sure.
How can we bring it closer to us?
Internet. First of all, During the corona pandemic, I found myself completely alone. So we just started renting a place in Oxford at that time. And obviously for my safety, also being asthmatic, we had to stop having guests. So I thought to myself, okay, do I go into solitude now, or is there a way that I can serve? And I put everything online. I just started trying to give teachings and think of different ways to help people. So things that might attract people in different ways. So we had, for example, some dedications and blessings every week. We had metta meditation every week. We had a Dhamma talk with questions and answers. And we created this beautiful online community. And I think at Bodhinyana you did the same. You had some teachings, not exactly the same, but you had some live streams like every week, some guided meditations. And I know it's not the same. Like being here now and seeing people and feeling the atmosphere is completely different. But still, even in a Zoom group, you know, friendships form and you get to feel a sense of safety. So I had people from literally all over the world. And one of the things I'm really pleased about in my community, and I think comes through being maybe a bhikkhuni who's fairly marginalised myself, is that we tend to attract a lot of other marginalised groups. So people from the LGBTQIA plus community, people with disabilities who maybe can't get to retreats physically or can't come to talks. You know, they were so happy. They said, wow, I never thought I'd hear talks by Buddhist monastics anymore. And here they were getting it like three times a week into their personal living space. So we had people from everywhere, and that's translated into hopefully building a stronger community. So many of those people now are wanting to come and visit, come and stay. And, you know, this is a possibility for everybody, because the Buddha did say that spiritual friendship is like the whole of the spiritual path. And it's precisely because we're conditioned, right? We're conditioned by everything around us and by the people we speak to. The difference between having like an uplifting conversation with someone who sees your qualities compared to being kind of berated at work for something you didn't do, right? Or even just somebody fault-finding on the slightest thing. It has a huge effect on our sense of well-being, safety, ability to relax. So yeah, spiritual community is everything. And, you know, the solitude that I was able to taste was only possible because of community. That's the irony there. You know, there was a huge community who I've known for many years and who were kind enough and generous enough to support me through that. You know, there was one young man who's now training with Ajahn Brahm who basically arranged my food for 6 months every day. He had a whole team of people helping, but he was the one looking after everything so that I had exactly the right food for my physical condition. And it was that that made it feel not lonely, you know? Because I think it's easy to like say, oh yeah, solitude's very easy, you know, no problem. But it's easy in the context of a feeling of belonging and a kind of safe space where you feel that you're loved and you're accepted.
Yeah. Some more questions from the audience.
No. Is it possible to get too detached and too comfortable in your own company?
Yes, I would say. Because you can't be in your own company, you know, all the time. And it's unfair to be in your own company all the time. It's dangerous to be in your own company all the time. So eventually you have to leave the solitude, then you go and talk to people, and you interact with people, and you share with people. The whole idea of sharing is a beautiful part of all types of life. It's one of the reasons why whenever I see kids doing exams at school, I always feel just how terrible that is. You're doing an exam, maybe an important exam, and you can't share the answers with your friends. They call it cheating. I can't see that as cheating, I can call that sharing. And in real life, you know, if there's a problem you have and you can't solve it yourself, what do? You ask a friend. That sharing is really important, and it doesn't matter how much solitude you have, how wise you are, there's still many things you'll never see and understand in life. That's why we're always learning. It's one of the reasons, sorry to keep going back on this, but you know, I've noticed that many people respect me, but they keep telling me that some things, because I'm a man, I'm a monk, that I'll never really fully understand, which is why we need bhikkhunis, why we need monastics who are LGBTQIA+. We need them, because they're the ones who can share their experiences with others.
Yeah.
Schizophrenics, we need those to be able to be wise enough. And I know a couple, one in particular I always keep, he inspires me. He's a monk, a great teacher. He's on clozapine. He's a schizophrenic, but you would not know. So there's many people like that, which is wonderful to include them in. Inclusiveness. To think that that's not part of spirituality is just ridiculous. Of all professions, spirituality should be inclusive and respect what each person has to offer.
Yeah, I think in addition to the marginalised communities sharing their wisdom and their perspective, it's also important that people in positions of privilege, and I think you understand that you count as that, also share. And so I think this is one of your really great, you know, qualities, that you will do what you can to help others, knowing that you've had a lot of support yourself that other people might have worked just as hard for and somehow been unable to access. So I think it's really important that anybody who is, you know, in more of a position of privilege, whether due to being white or male or physically able or straight, actually makes the effort to get to understand how it is not to be in that situation and to share some of their privileges and gains. So, yeah, but for that you need dialogue, you need to share. We need to listen, learn.
Do people who have disability ever feel they're to blame? We should never feel like that, but sometimes they do. As if at some time in the world their disability or their schizophrenia, whatever else is hindering them, is somehow some divine punishment. And that is just gross. Anybody ever says that or thinks like that. That's one of the reasons, coming back to I'm not to blame. How many people take on the difficulties in their life and they blame themselves for it? Please, it's never a blame. Just, you go up there and just prove to people. That's what I always try and say. Prove to them that, believe it or not, that anything which is difficult for you becomes a blessing. Okay.
How do you reconcile the law of karma, where you are supposed to, you know, get as deserved with not blaming yourself?
Because that law of karma, which is both in Buddhism and in Hinduism, actually just part of life, is that it's not giving you a punishment, it's giving you different opportunities to learn and grow in different situations. And like I say this, I've done a lot of work with those who have had cancer or known very close people they love so much with cancer. And I was surprised to learn, working like that with such people, that many of them, so many of them, came to see me and they told me that that was the best thing which ever happened to them, that cancer. The first time I heard that, of course, it shocked me. The second time, I've heard that before. And the third time, and then they explained, 'cause I've never had cancer, but you explained to me that that just opened up their spirituality, their compassion, understanding what their life is really about. Is it really about just achieving things in life, a big house, you know, a nice car, a good education for your children? The material part of life is now put into perspective. when they find out just how fragile their body can be and how much it can hurt and how much just a smile and a bit of kindness means to each one of us. We feel it so much more when we're close to dying, when we're really sick. It's become the most important things of our life. And sometimes you think, why couldn't I see that before? So sometimes we might think that it is bad karma that happened to you. But you can look at it in another way, which is far more accurate. So it's a tough opportunity, but you're learning so much from it. You're growing so much. Never feel sorry for yourself. Feel privileged that, you know, you have to be in a wheelchair. Be privileged. I can't really say that, please, if I'm offending you, you'll throw something at me. But what I'm saying is that it's a nice... Yeah, feel good about yourselves. Feel good about just the situation you're in and see the benefits of it. See the positive. If people just...
Absolutely no problem with it.
Yeah, good.
Because I am not a wheelchair. I am me.
Good, yeah. Excellent.
Can I ask you a follow-up on this question about karma?
Yeah.
Because there is this thing about, you know, guilt in our culture, and we sometimes think it's because of our, you know, cultural religion that we learned from early on that we are, you know, flawed. We are born with a sin. We have to sort of, you know, just be forgiven at one point. But in one sense, the Christianity promises you a free pass, which the karma does not. Can you? Yeah.
We know that sometimes there's all sorts of advertising campaigns. They promise you all sorts of things, but they don't deliver. But the whole idea of, like, sin, that gives, like, hierarchies power over you, if you believe that. Because, you know, if you've done some terrible sin, the priest or the nun tells you what's going to happen to you, of course they have power over you. And that is a type of religion which I just really don't agree with at all. Even if that's Buddhism, if you say find a monk or a nun and say, if you don't do this, something bad will happen to you, and they say that that's the law of karma, that's not how karma works at all. Karma is not a punishment. Karma is like you go to a school, you're learning something, you don't pass the exam this year, you can pass it next time. It's like for learning and growing, never for punishing. Never call it that any of you have failed. But please excuse me, this story, I say it so often, but it's I find it one of the best stories about each one of you sitting here. You remind me of trees in the forest which are all bent and twisted and damaged. Some look more damaged than others, but if you look at each one of those twisted, bent trees, each one of them belongs. There is never, I've lived in forests all my life, I've never seen a perfect tree. You go looking for one. There's always mistakes in them. Branches which are broken, leaves which are going brown, or leaves which have been eaten by bugs. Every tree in the forest is imperfect, like each human being sitting in front of me right now. Number one, you're welcome. And number two, this is not an exaggeration. The most bent and twisted and damaged trees become my favorites. They look the most beautiful. So why do you think there's something wrong with that tree? Because it's twisted and bent. Leave it alone, that's my favourite. Don't try and heal it or cure it. I love it as it is. That's each one of you. Don't ever think that Buddhism is here to make you a perfect human being. It's for you to be able to accept yourself as a failed, flawed, bent, twisted, bad joke-telling monk. That's who I am, and I'm happy to be like that. So do you get the message there? Don't try ever to cure yourself. Care for yourself. I don't know. What do you think about that? It's okay to complain. I told this recently that do you ever know why it is that when you go to Buddhist temples, the traditional ones, you always have to take your shoes off and leave them outside? You know why? So if a monk like me tells a bad joke, you can't throw anything at me.
People kept their boots, Ajahn.
Yeah, be careful.
Be careful.
Yeah,
be
careful.
Okay, I'll just try myself one more time with this karma stuff.
Okay, yeah.
Because it's one of you. Because it's the only thing that sort of in Buddhism that can feel like it's going the other way from kindness and being sort of supportive. It's some kind of heaviness for me, at least, connected with karma that you can't get away from it. It's you are the owner of your actions, whether they are good or bad, and from here on until eternity, it's like sort of, it's quite of a hard message somehow.
Mm. Now you can let go of any karma anytime. This is weird. It's to realize you don't own it. In other words, this sense of ownership of our past. But to be technical about this, once you become a stream winner, you realize you don't own this. You can let it go. And there's a word for it in Pali called ahosi karma. You know, the karma that was. So it just disappears. I remember having great arguments with psychologists, senior psychologists. They said, no, you can't do that. Yes, you can. It's just like you've been carrying these heavy bags full of rocks. Because you think you have to, you've done something bad or terrible. If you look at it, it wasn't bad or terrible, you were just really confused. You thought that's the best thing you could do. You were emotionally just distraught or not clear. And people do these things. Honestly, I've never seen a couple of bad people, in senior parts of government. But, no, it's not actually not really a joke. We'll take this off if it's going to be controversial. But one of the worst persons I ever saw, scariest, he was the president of the Khmer Republic, Hun Sen. It really scared me. Very powerful, but not the kindness there at all. So there's a few people like that, but they're very, very rare. So many of you here, that you are good people. And why have this terrible thing about something you did in the past? Honestly, you thought you were trying to do the very best. Maybe you didn't realize, what actually happened, or why it happened, and how much it hurts. And you regret it afterwards. This is even prisoners I used to talk to in jail. After a while, when they got to trust you, they would come to you. Every one of them said they felt so guilty about what they did. They wish they hadn't done that. They hadn't taken that drug or got so drunk. They wish, but of course they're stuck with that. So it's people like me had to tell them because they trust me. I've got a robe on, a bald head. I don't know why you trust me because you have this funny uniform on. But anyway, they do trust. And I tell them, look, that was a long time in the past. Please forgive it, let it go, and learn from it. So you never have to do that ever again.
Can I add something also?
Oh, please, yeah.
Firstly, I think we often misunderstand karma. I mean, firstly, we're actually talking about it and presuming that it's all about bad karma. right? Because we're talking about the things we've done that are bad, and that's what makes us worry about some consequence. And we also talk about it as something in the past, that come as something we've done, you know, that's now going to kind of come and bite us. But the way that the Buddha talked about karma is that karma is intention, and it's our intention now that is karma. So for me, it's a very liberating teaching. Firstly, because if I am generating unwholesome thoughts or unwholesome karma, I would have been doing that anyway, right? Before coming to the Dhamma. So now that I'm in the Dhamma, I actually have much more opportunity to be aware of my intention and to add the kindness to that. So I see it all as a win-win thing, because you would have been just rolling on with your conditioning and acting in ways that you were unaware of, maybe going towards the light, maybe going towards, you know, misery. But now we've got the chance to be aware of what's happening in our minds right now and actually remember that this is where we create our future. So we can add that kindness, you know, the three right intentions, that's the strongest karma. Letting go, non-ownership, non-control, kindness, metta, loving kindness, and compassion and gentleness. So I see it almost like something natural that's inside of us, like a kind of compass for our life. So if there was no karma, you would do a kind act and you wouldn't feel good. It wouldn't make any difference, right, to your well-being. But because of karma, we can do something beautiful and then we feel the result. So we can know what good karma is and what negative karma is by the way we feel. So I think this is very empowering, yeah, personally.
Maybe to add one more thing, this is a little question, I think I mentioned this a day or two ago, that because, you know, I am a well-known monk, I get the great opportunities of visiting so many different locations. And one of my really good friends, he was one of the head monks over in Indonesia, and his monastery is very close to the ancient monument called Borobudur in the middle of Java. If you've ever been there, it's a tourist attraction, but it's also got some very wonderful carvings on the different levels of Borobudur. And one of those carvings is one of my favourites just because of the meaning of that. And it was of this story was of this man who had injured his own mother, had really hurt her. And so after he died, he went, now don't, this is just like a metaphor, okay? Don't think that you may have hurt your mother and this is going to happen to you. Don't think like that, please. That he went down to this hellish realm where he saw somebody else having his head cut with a razor wheel continuously, incredible pain. And then this man who was being tortured by this razor wheel so said that he was told he would have to endure this punishment for 360 years. And then afterwards another man would come and who'd done the same thing as he'd done, injured his mother, and the wheel would go from his head into this new man's head. And that's what happened. So the old man who'd been tortured for 360 years was now free. And this new guy, know, with the wheel cutting into his skull, said, it was a terrible thing I did, it was a terrible thing to endure, but out of compassion for other beings who will have to endure this, I will willingly take this punishment for three times 360 years, out of compassion for others. And just that kindness made his razor wheel just shatter. And then he got immediately reborn in some heaven realm. Okay, that's a story, but what it taught me was this matter of just how much you are hurting, and it may have been from some bad actions. If you change your attitude towards it, you can be free in an instant. And I mean that. Kindness overcomes any idea of self-punishment. And all those punishments which you have in your life, if you think it's a punishment, you have a choice to learn, let go, and do away with all this punishment business. you don't deserve it. I don't know why people feel that, even in, please excuse me, like the original sin. Who did the original sin in Christianity?
Adam.
No, Adam. Who got punished? Eve.
That's about right.
Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous. So anyway, you can check your Bible if you want. But that whole idea of punishment makes absolutely no sense to me. If you did something wrong, you made a mistake. Admit it and make sure you do better next time. Okay, come on. Do you agree with that? How many of you sinners are here?
In monastic life, we have a really wonderful process. It's part of the our Vinaya, so our monastic conduct. And we meet together every 2 weeks and actually share all the things that we've made mistakes about. And this is really wonderful because the Buddha always said, you know, as long as you expose it, you're transparent, you're honest to it, that's growth on the path. That's not a backward step. So that makes it really beautiful. So every time you make a mistake, you think, great, now I can tell my teacher.
Oh, yeah.
So, hotline.
Yeah.
And immediately, you know, you feel very true and honest in yourself. And just being transparent in that way makes it very less likely that you'll keep repeating because you're bringing awareness to your conduct and also an understanding of cause and effect.
So what's my favourite punishment for you?
Your favourite punishment?
Yes.
It's usually hugging the teddy bear, to be honest, because I'm allergic to cats.
Oh, yeah.
So he usually says, find a teddy bear and give it a hug.
And this all started, if you know Australia, I think I said this story to you before. In Australia, they used to have these terrible punishments of whippings for convicts. So when this one guy, he confessed to me some terrible thing he'd done. You know what he did? He broke his precept by stealing a sandwich at night time and eating it. The poor young man was hungry.
You're not supposed to eat after 12.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, when he came up to me, he said, I'd slept all night, I've been a terrible trainee, I ate something last night, I stole it from the kitchen. No, please, I'm terribly sorry. And of course I told him, said, okay, thank you for telling me. There's all these other things you can do, you can eat. If you want to find out all the stuff which monks and nuns can eat in the evening, I don't know why anybody wants to have a dinner with all the honey and the chocolate and the cheese, and that's only the start of it. But anyhow, this young man told me that he needs to be punished. And he wouldn't let me go. He said, if you don't punish me, I'll do it again, I know. So I had to think up a punishment for him, an appropriate Australian punishment. So the punishment I sentenced him to, I was the abbot of the monastery, I had authority. I said, I sentence you to 50 strokes of the cat. And he thought I was going to whip him 50 times. And then I said, there's two cats at that time in the monastery. Find one of them, put it on your lap, and stroke it 50 times. One, two, three. Learn some compassion, some kindness. Now it's his punishment. Can you really call that a punishment? To learn some kindness and forgiveness? He said he had to do that 50 times.
Did he do it?
I believe so.
Okay.
Chanda,
yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
I was curious, what kind of topics come up in this fortnight meetings where you confess? What kind of typical sins have been...
Typical sins? Wow. The types of things that normally come up in, as far as I know from the nuns community, are things like breaking that precept of food, maybe going home to the family and then not finishing quite on time, maybe damaging a plant, you know, because we have the rule not to, like, dig the earth in case there's any beings there and not to damage plants, so sometimes that happens. Nothing too serious as far as I've heard from the bikini community, but it can get more serious.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know about the monks.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sometimes the monks are at the back of the line.
Oh. No, the front of the line.
Sometimes they go to the back.
Okay, you know what I did once? That I received as a gift a big bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey. Did. What happened? This was like a Thai tradition. It's a stupid tradition. Please never do this. They had the idea that if you offer something to a senior monk, then their deceased father or grandfather will get that up in heaven. So they had to find a way of giving some Johnny Walker to me so their granddad could drink some up in heaven. So you know what they did? They choose a busy time and they put this bottle of Johnny Walker in this big bucket of other things like soap and toothpaste and tissue paper and stuff. And it was so busy, they just gave it to me and I received it and I sent it downstairs. And then my anagarics came up and said, Ajahn Brahm, do you realise you have just accepted a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey? And I said, I never saw it. He said, well, you accepted it. So I said, yeah, okay. But I tell people, please, don't ever think like that. You know, that if you give a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey to a nun, then your grandmother will be able to receive some up in heaven. No way.
Oh, you know, one thing that somebody once offered to me, the funniest thing that anyone's offered, they knew we were struggling because it was at the beginning of the project, so we needed some, like, regular sponsorship, some regular donations coming in. So they said, oh, would you consent to eating this really rotten, stinking fish every week so that I can get that in heaven when I die? And as a result of that, I'll give you £200 a week if you eat this disgusting fish. But I don't know if this is the right place to tell that, because I don't know what sort of fish you eat. But this was bad. This was like the kind of stuff they put in the jars and it gets grown with maggots and worms and it's like sticky stuff.
What's it
so
called?
It's like, oh, what should we do? You know, should we take the £200 and just pretend to eat it? So my friend wrote a really long, quite a hilarious email back to say that that wouldn't be appropriate. So yeah, but they don't offer nuns whiskey. That's one good thing, because they don't think that nuns are going to bring that much merit.
Yeah. You're lucky.
If you give to monks, you get more merit. Meritocracy, they call
meritocracy, but you don't get any merit out of giving bad things.
You don't. And today we had a beautiful day where we were invited to one of the Norwegian monks' mother's house. And she actually offered lapskaus. Is that right?
Lapskaus.
Bantinito's grimacing. Sorry, Bante. By my pronunciation. And it was the first time that anyone here, I think, had given a meal, or any woman in Norway had given a meal to both the monks and the nuns' community. And the Buddha said very clearly in the suttas that anything given to both sanghas, so to the bhikkhunis as well as the bhikkhus, and shared basically, would be most productive of goodness. So she did that today.
Biggest bang for your bucks.
Biggest bang, yeah. And there was such a lot of warmth and happiness.
Yeah, that's great. That's one of the nice things, the way we live with Dana, that it's such a joyful thing. People come, we share our meal together. And so just the joy which people have, you know, just having the one and only nun in this part of the world to your house, and feeding them. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Sorry, you had a question?
Yes, I want to ask something about anger and sadness. If I've understood it right, is that if you're in deep anger, then you're creating more dukkha, right? So what I heard now from my mom is that if you're in deep sadness, it's similar to being very angry. Is that true, or is that, how can I understand?
Do you want to?
Yeah, I would say anger is worse, simply because it can go to other people very easily. Sadness is very personal. I'm only saying an approximation. And
often anger can pass pretty quickly, but sadness can last a long time. Even seeing little kids, that they get very angry at each other, but that goes pretty quickly. They're great to learn from. Sadness is just more deep-rooted. And the sadness comes from when we don't learn just how to see the 998 good bricks in the world instead of the two bad bricks. And we just, for some reason or another, we deny ourselves a view of the sunset. All we see is the darkness of the night. And then we can't smell a flower. We think we've got hay fever and we're going to blow our nose because of it. So much. Honestly, I'm a monk. There's so much joy in this world. And when you develop some sensitivity in your mind, some peace in the mind, you also develop so much energy in the mind. So if you are very sad, I mean like a long-standing sadness, even like depression, we were just talking about this the other day, or actually today probably, I think it was. One of the best antidotes to sadness or depression is going to do some social work. Look after the temple, or look after the church, or look after elderly people. Mm. And you think you're going there to do a service, but actually they're serving you. You teach so, you learn so much, you do some community service. And also, you know, you make so many lovely friends. Mm. And you're doing something good with your life. So wipe the floors with your tears, rather than just use so much toilet paper.
Can I add a little bit to that?
Yeah, oh, please.
Because I think you're often speaking about coming out of these emotions and looking
yeah.
to the positive.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe in a contrast or maybe complementary way, I also think it can be different when we meditate. Because the whole attitude to what comes up when we meditate is not to push it away. And I think that when sadness and anger arise, it's an opportunity to learn to be with that in a really kind way and just investigate what is it like. And just through that kind awareness, we can come in contact with it and actually gain a deeper understanding into our own minds. And I found for myself that like stigmatizing any emotion is always building suffering for myself. You know, just the anger and the sadness by themselves are not wrong. You're not creating bad karma. You know, it's what you do with those things, it's how you respond to those things that actually takes you either on a path towards happiness through the so-called afflictive emotions, or it takes you into more anger and more sadness. And sometimes I think feeling we shouldn't have them actually takes us into them even more, because then we feel sad that we're sad, or angry that we're angry, and angry that we're angry that we're angry, and the whole thing just builds. So I think first of all remove the stigma, because this is nature. It's not your fault. It's coming because of causes in the past. And it's how we respond to it that really matters. So, yeah, and in everyday life, of course, you know, looking for the joy, trying to change your perception, doing beautiful things for others. But I find that when I'm in touch with my own sadness, I'm even more inspired to respond with compassion and do good.
So you shouldn't blame yourself.
For what, being sad?
That's the title of the talk.
Oh. It helps me embrace my emotions.
Yeah.
If I feel like I'm feeling it, so that I understand not only me, but I can respond better to others then as well. So they have a use, they have a purpose.
Can I ask one question? We talk about blame and mistakes. What if parents, who are the people we should respect the most as children, what if they do mistakes because they're also parents, humans? How to find a balance as a child or as a family member what is a good viewpoint on that?
You mean your parents aren't perfect? No parents are perfect. That's one of the things you learn as a child. They always want your parents to be perfect, but you find they're faulty. It's a wonderful lesson to learn, because then you find that you're faulty too. You don't blame them for being imperfect. Look, I said this story, I think, yesterday in the men's night about my own father and my father's father. My own father's father was violent, abusive, would come home drunk. This was in Liverpool, before the Second World War, would take off his belt and just beat anybody who happened to be, you know, in reach of the belt for no reason whatsoever. So sometimes my father got a belt in. He said he could take that, but one thing he could never accept was when his father, my paternal grandfather, set that belt on his wife, my dad's mum, and he couldn't protect her. And that was just intolerable. So it was a terrible thing that his father did. The result of that was my father taught me about unconditional love and forgiveness. He told me that, you know, many times, this was in the 50s and 60s, you know, that many times my brother and I did play around, but he could not spank us. He just couldn't do it, because it brought back all those memories of what his father did to him. And so because of that, you know, he taught me, you don't need to have punishment to have that discipline and growth in the house. So that's what he learned, you know, from his parents, so-called misbehaving. Well, they didn't, or his father did. But he grew so much from it. So that's what we can do.
Yeah, and I think also to, okay, so we're taught that we should respect our parents, but really it's not about respecting the person, I think it's about respecting behaviour. So if you see, okay, this behaviour, I don't respect the behaviour, and this behaviour I do respect, this is very different from actually blaming a person. And then you can make a choice for yourself. Okay, this behaviour that I don't respect is not something I want to do. You know, I know how it feels, I know what the consequences are, and this behaviour is worthy of respect, let me cultivate it in myself. So in that way, they become also a very good teacher. And to realise that, you know, if they're behaving like the way your grandfather behaved,
yeah,
it may well be that his dad beat him.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So it just goes back and back and back, but what we can do is say it stops here. And I think that's what your dad did, isn't
he?
He sort of made a resolution never to perpetuate that harm. So it's not wrong, you know, to say, okay, my parents display some behaviour that I don't respect, but you don't have to disrespect them as people. So there's a difference there.
Yeah, so being an expert, I was wondering if you could just maybe give like a sketch of what it means to like discover yourself through meditation. What is like the process of starting and developing that inner journey? I'm a great fan of meditation myself, but you don't have to consider my background, just
yeah,
anyone interested. What does it mean to discover yourself through meditation, and what is the role of meditation?
Okay. First of all, meditation has the purpose of giving you enough stillness. Now the best simile, which I've given often, is a simile of going up into the mountains, you know, here in Norway, finding a forest lake, or sorry, a lake up in the mountains, on a night where there's no wind and a full moon. And then to see the reflection of that full moon in a still, calm lake up in the mountains is one of the most beautiful images. Because the stillness causes you, or allows you, to see things undistorted. And that stillness is very, very powerful. And you can see much more deeply wherever you want to look. And this is, you know, where the power of meditation can also assist in your world, in your job, in your life. Because you're seeing more sensitively and more accurately, instead of being bent, you know, by just seeing what you want to see and being in denial to what's too challenging for you, you actually see what we call the truth. It's training this thing we call the mind to be free of wanting or not wanting, so you don't bend the truth. And then you can put that attention inside this person who bears your name and find out, what is this person? What is this thing which people call a self, which knows and which does things and which owns what is done in the past. And that's where the law of karma comes in. If you see what this self is, or rather what it's not, then you can let go so much of the past. You become free. So this is actually where you find out who you are. You need to train the mind so you can see clearly. It's also just, it's actually fun to do. You get so much joy and happiness out of meditating. It's the biggest bliss available on this planet in meditation. That's one of the reasons whenever I teach about meditation, I tell the story. The first time I got into a deep meditation, I was still a lay person, I had a girlfriend, we were having good sex. I'm being honest with you. And then I went to meditate, it was better than sex. Much, much, much better. Better than sexual orgasm. And that just blew me away. And the thing which I said to myself afterwards, why didn't anybody tell me about this before? So I feel it's necessary that I tell you about that. The bliss states. And it's not just a sense of pleasure, I mean, that's enough. But the fact afterwards your mind is so clear, peaceful, penetrating, that's where the wisdom comes from. Okay, there was one, another one, and then the lady in front afterwards. There's somebody over there first. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering, how should we deal with people close to us, partners or other types of people who think that our Dharma practice in general is just like a mumbo jumbo?
It's great that they think like that, at least they're thinking about it. But after a while, they find you a much better person after you practice a weekend mumbo-jumbo retreat.
Yeah, that's my next question. So, you talked a lot about retreat and six months retreat. So, it's like two sort of questions. It's like for someone sitting here like us, it would be like, how do we get to because it's 6 months of retreat of silence, how do we get there as like from not, say, for meditating an hour every day, up to meditating for 12 hours a day? And what would be a general, like, sort of, like, normal schedule in a, sort of, like, a six-month retreat that you were talking about as well? Because you said you were meditating for 12 hours a day. Are you actually just sitting on a, doing, yeah, so maybe you can explain what type of meditation techniques or prayers or that sort of thing.
Yeah. I don't think either of us went straight into a six-month retreat.
Yeah, that was what
so
I
was
thinking.
Many, many years of practice.
Yeah.
And for me, it was never something like I have to stretch to. It just became natural that the more I let go of, the more I wanted to go inside. So for me, I did start with quite intensive retreats, which made you sit for 12 hours a day, but of course you voluntarily sign up for those retreats. And that was a fantastic training for me to really go inside and look at the mind. So I came to the point in my life where I realised happiness can't be found outside. So I really wanted to look at what was going on and how I was creating my own happiness and suffering and what would happen if I just stayed with myself. So there was a structure and we were meditating in a group with very clear instructions, but I had to take that time, you know, I had to take 10 days. And then the emphasis was very much on trying to establish a daily practice, and that's what I did for the next years. So I put a lot of dedication and commitment into that. But, you know, I was doing 2 hours a day as a layperson throughout all my lay life, but also giving a lot of service. And I think that was really what clicked it for me. Because just being in, like, intensive retreat and then coming back into the world, there can be a real kind of jarring effect. And you don't quite know how you can, like, make that bridge. But then if you can also give voluntary service on retreats, you know, if Bhante Nito, Ajahn Nito here, organises a retreat, go and help, you know. And if you've got a bit of experience in meditation, you can then apply that to other people and the struggles that they go through. So this really helps you understand the nature of the mind and gives you confidence that, you know, any of your struggles are not yours alone. And then bit by bit, for me, I just started to love meditation. I found it completely fascinating to be inside looking at how this whole thing works and getting the peace and the calm that seemed much more reliable than anything in the world. So it just became natural that I had more and more appetite for silence and solitude and meditation over the time. But it's not essential to go that way, you know. The most important thing is how it's changing you in your life and how you're applying the insights you learn on retreat and the stillness, how you bring that into your life and how that starts to bring benefit for yourself and others. That's the most important thing. So, yeah. Anything to add to that, though?
Well, good. Mm.
Thank you. I was just wondering, in our busy world and busy minds, when you start meditating, it sometimes can take a long time before you really are able to experience this deep silence or the real benefits of the meditation. How do you motivate yourself to keep going? That's my question.
Exactly. We were talking about that, or you mentioned that,
yeah.
Noticing that many people, when they start meditating the first time, they don't know what to expect, and they can get some very lovely experiences at the very beginning.
Mm.
They trust that the people who are teaching that, and they just follow the instructions, and it works. And later on, they start thinking about it, and it makes it more complicated. But nevertheless, the motivation is the benefits you get from it. Now, when I started meditation, I had some great meditations to begin with, but even though they were great meditations, I remember just being in a coffee shop, I don't know where in the world, with this French guy, and he was saying that he was meditating. I said, oh, well, I used to meditate, but not that much anymore. And that was me. And then he said, why? I said, well, I just got many other things I have to do in my life. And then he said, why don't you have a look at how you feel at the end of every meditation and compare that to what it was like at the beginning. That's what he told me, and I started doing that. And even what I thought was bad meditations, they were actually much better than not meditating at all. I could see the benefits of it, of every meditation I did. From that time on, I never called anything a bad meditation. And of course, some meditations were okay, some were fantastic. And I can't resist this story, because, you know, sometimes I tell old jokes, but this is one I made up myself, and it's very useful. It was a migrant came to Norway, came to Oslo, and he was a doctor in his home country. But when he came to Oslo, his qualifications were not recognized. So he had to get any job he could. He got a job on a building site. He was fit, he was clever, he worked very hard. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, he worked hard. He didn't get any pay. And he thought, these people in Norway are just very cruel. They exploit migrants. They work very hard, but they don't give you any pay. He went to work on Thursday, again, still no pay. He told his wife, he's not going to work on Friday. Why should I go to work? I really bust my gut, as they say, working hard, and no one pays me anything. And on Friday, his boss called him into the office and gave him a big pay packet. So when he went home, he told his wife, I figured out how it works in Norway now. From now on, I'm only going to work on Fridays. On payday. And of course, you get paid on Friday for all the work you've done Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And that's an interesting thing with meditation. You get your paychecks, but not every meditation. The big paychecks come every now and again, and they make the whole thing worth it.
It's interesting, Ajahn. Can I say something?
Yes, yeah, sure.
Interesting. Because you say that you don't say good or bad meditations, but then you do say that some are okay and some are fantastic. So how can you reconcile that?
Well, it is good and very good. Not bad.
Okay. Well, yeah, to add to that, I mean, the way that I try to overcome that assessment, I guess, is to change the idea of why I meditate. Like, it's not to get some pleasant experience. If it happens, great. But it's to understand my mind. So if you sit down with that as a kind of aim, you know, that we're meditating just to understand what's going on, you actually can't fail. It's impossible to fail. And I think that's maybe what you mean when you say there's no good or bad. Like, at the end, you look at your mind, you look at what you've done in the meditation, and you find, did it lead me to happiness or not? You know, did it lead me to peace? How much peace? How much agitation? What are my weaknesses? What are the kind of obstacles I tend to face? And then you know more about yourself. The other thing I think is really helpful is not to sit thinking, what is it going to give me? Like, what's going to be the outcome of my practice? But to actually maybe change your practice completely to being more about what you can give. Like, how can I really give myself some peace? How can I give myself some acceptance, some love? And then make the whole practice about what you're actually, how you're relating to what you experience. So see how much kindness you can give, how much gentleness you can give. And one way to do that that's very easy is to practice loving kindness as a practice. And for me, I find that incredible, because if I'm doing it for myself, it's like, yeah, I kind of care about my own benefit, but I'm really concerned about other people as well. And I think as women, we often put other people before ourselves, you know, and our own benefit. Yeah, I'll give myself a bit of time just so I can carry on looking after everyone else. So what I find with the metta is that if I take someone who's suffering and then I make my whole practice about sending them metta, I'm not looking at my own outcome at all. I'm just giving to that person and I'm just focused on their well-being and benefit. And afterwards, it's incredible. You can feel so light. So this ties into the whole like thrust of the path, which is actually giving, letting go. So I find that really helpful, the metta practice. And it has a very beautiful sweetness too.
Excuse me. Could you give me an example of metta practice?
Yeah, so yesterday with my ladies group, we did some metta meditation. And I think of it in two ways. Like, sometimes we can infuse our awareness with a sense of kindness and warmth, so it becomes more like perceiving everything with a sense of embracing and kindness and letting it be. So that I kind of call metta as a perception, or metta as a way of relating. That's just my own kind of way of describing it. And then there's also what I'd call metta as a cultivation. So when we use the metta practice to actually develop deep states of stillness, and it becomes like an object of meditation in and of itself. So that's when we maybe don't take the breath as our object or the body sensations, but we actually take another being initially as the object of our meditation. And then we can do it in different ways. But the way I like to start is to contact my body, especially the area around the heart or any place in the body that feels easeful and relaxed. And then I kind of bring up in my mind the image or the sense, the presence of this person towards whom it's quite easy to develop a mind of loving kindness towards. And you can kind of gauge whether it's the right person by whether or not bringing them to mind gives you a sense of uplift and happiness and a sense of ease. So there are some people in the world we feel really safe with, you know, we feel really accepted by. And if we have a quite straightforward, uncomplicated relationship with, not too many expectations or agendas, because that can really spoil it. And you bring them to mind and you just can start by wishing them well, like from the heart. So mentally inside your mind you can repeat phrases like, may you be happy, may you be safe, may you be free from suffering, may you be at peace. But make those phrases really relevant to that person and to what you really genuinely wish. Because the danger with any practice, whether it's breath or metta, is that it becomes like automatic and we just start like, may you be happy, may you be well, and then you're like singing a song. You know, it's just like a sort of monotonous repetition. So the way I do it is like to get in contact with the meaning of that phrase and then to listen, like allow the mind to follow in that direction. And this is how you've taught it too, you know, to really give that space between each phrase, to let the mind just intuit what metta means. And you just keep going like that. And you find that metta, just starts to grow. It's quite a magical process.
What do you mean it starts to grow? What is growing?
I feel the heart softens and it becomes wider and there's more room for everything. There's more room for this being, but then also sometimes other beings pop up to mind. And I shared with the group yesterday, the ladies group, that I'd been through this trauma with one ex-nun, actually, and a very, very close friend. And I was kind of advised by people, maybe who didn't understand trauma, to send metta to this person. But it was far too triggering, so I didn't do that because it just caused all this, you know, kind of intense trauma to arise again. So instead of that, I just started developing metta to a friend during a long retreat. And one day when the metta was really, really strong, this person just popped up. And it was like they just joined the flow of metta. Like there was a lot of feeling of brightness and expansiveness and safety inside myself. And this person just dropped in and I was completely unaffected. Like it didn't have the impact it would normally have. And from that time on, I was able to talk about what happened and think of this person without any impact anymore. And I think this is also related to karma, because you could call what had happened and the thoughts of what had happened the effect in the present. But when that effect meets the mind of metta, and that mind is very wide and expansive, it just doesn't have the same impact. It doesn't cause the same suffering. So this is another way to dilute the karma, if you like.
I think the subject of metta is kind of a nice, perhaps, ending to this talk, because it's to me it's like the antidote for all the negative emotions that we mentioned, the guilt, the blame, the shame. So if you are able to develop this beautiful feeling of loving kindness within you, that would sort of subdue over time the negative emotions.
So long as you don't do it to subdue the negative emotions, that's the catch. We have to do it really unconditionally, being willing to feel and experience anything that arises, because it's really not our fault.
And the concept of actually cultivating these things are also, I just remember when I started meditating, the idea that you can actually cultivate positive emotions is quite sort of weird, and I was like deeply against the concept from the beginning, but it works.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, you can make use of the fact that we are just these conditioned processes. If we're conditioned, if we're kind of, you know, summation of every experience we've had, then why don't we try and condition that in a positive way? So, you know, the mind is malleable, the mind can be changed, and that is karma in action. So it's an extremely hopeful, positive path. We can really choose which direction we want to go.
Hi. I'm wondering, what would you advise to people? Like, we were talking about holding the space for the emotions during the meditation practice, but what would you advise to people who went through some more like traumatic experience and they just cannot hold, they are more triggered during the practice? So what would you advise for those kind of people in the practice?
I'm going to let Ajahn answer, but first I'll just say again the metta practice that I described as a regular practice, because this will give you a sense of resilience and a sense of having that wide expansiveness of mind, so that when these things arise, they don't impact you so much. So, but I think you have also some very beautiful methods to,
yes, and
to turn toward.
This particular method was never invented by me. It was an adapted by that little story about opening the door of your heart as a way of stating unconditional loving kindness. And it was used by a group over in Perth, and they are called ASSETS. It's the acronym for Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. And these are people, men and women, and LGBTQIA+, who have been treated so brutally, painfully, by various regimes in the world. And they managed to find themselves as refugees in countries like Australia, where physically they're safe, but their emotions, their memories of that past trauma still stops them having a meaningful life. And so this little group, they use that opening the door of your heart teaching. And to take it in brief, that after a person feels safe in that environment, in this little facility called Assets, the safety is the first requirement. And the people around them, they've made a relationship of trust. And then they sit them down on a chair or anywhere safe. And then they ask them just to relax and imagine in their heart two doors. And those two doors open out. And inside those two doors is the person who you can accept and live with. The little girl who was not raped, the boy who wasn't mercilessly beaten, the person who was not tortured. And then that person's inside. We look outside and on the ground in the cold, damp, hard concrete, you can recognize that little girl who was so badly abused, the boy who was beaten so badly. Not just one of you, but many of you out there. And they're outside of you. And you next imagine a staircase going down from your heart to the ground. If any time that this is too much, then you can just come out. But if you are ready for it, you invite those little beings, who are you? They were who you are. Not your fault, but that was what happened. Each one of those beings you invite up the staircase, taking their time, and you're standing at the top of that staircase, welcoming them, hugging them, saying things like, I'll never keep you out of my heart ever again. The door of my heart is open to each one of you. Come in. It takes a lot, and it's very emotionally just huge. Once that last little man, last little woman has come up, is inside your heart rather than outside, the person changes. Never again do they think they can't face what happened to them. Never again do they think that these people need to be chased outside and forgotten forever. They come inside. When I've seen, I always remember the story of this woman who came to our center, and she was one of these people who had been traumatized so badly. And when I was just talking to somebody else, and she was talking to this one of the boys who come to our center, and the boy was listening as she told her what had happened to her. And it was, you know, he said, that's disgusting what happened to you. That's terrible. And then she said, you have no right to say that. That's who I am. And I learned from that. Dug in that stinky, please excuse me, shit, which you were given. And you've made this beautiful garden out of it. You turn the feces into fertilizer. And it's, which is incredible to see that. So that's one way of dealing with it. And it works. And there's a couple of psychologists adapted this. And I just think, wow. Thank you for using something which my father told me so many years ago and using it with so much power to help people who are free in a compassionate country can also be free in their mind. So that's one thing which can be done.
Okay. Yes. I think maybe we should end it for tonight. I'm really, really happy that you could come to visit Oslo and us, and for the beautiful days we've had, and this evening especially, it's been really, really nice. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to you who came here to share this with us.
A pleasure. Please don't forget Ajahn Nito over there. He's been the one behind the scenes making sure everything's worked out okay.
Yeah, and I would really like to say thank you to Ajahn Nito for inviting not only Ajahn Brown but also myself. It's been incredibly heartening to meet Dhamma brothers, people on the path who are fellow monks, you know, peers, if you like, other children of Ajahn. And to actually have discussions about how to include women and how to make, you know, a really equal and inclusive community here. And I think what you're doing is fantastic. It's the first time I've met not just one, but actually two Norwegian monks who, for them, there's just no question that everyone should be included. And yet it's the first time I've had that conversation with any monk. Can you imagine? Apart from my teacher, Ajahn Brown. Not including Perth. Not including the whole community in Perth.
Yeah.
But in Europe. And that's very sad to say, because we're supposed to be, like, you know, ahead of things, but actually we can sometimes be so stuck in tradition and carrying so much baggage and, you know, so many power structures already blocking this path forward. So it's been really quite wonderful to meet and to share ideas and, you know, to feel that support. So I just want to encourage everybody who wants to see more inclusivity to be an ally if you're in a privileged position. And if you are from a marginalized member community anywhere, please try to come, know that you're included, and also have your voice, you know, help form what happens here in Norway, because I think it's an absolutely wonderful initiative. And I can definitely vouch for Ajahn Nito, not that you need me to, but as a vikuni, you know, it's not many monks who I feel are genuine allies. And also to Jon, I'm not going to try and say your whole name because my pronunciation is terrible, and to everyone who's been supporting us, you know, you're all really sincere practitioners, and to Mona as well for organising the Women's Night. So yeah, it's been a real pleasure, thank you.
I'd like to just remind people that you can seek this project out on the internet. It's Anukampa Bikuni Project, and support Ayachanda, and it's also possible to come visit in Oxford.
In England, yeah.
In England. So to just write an email and check if it's available to come and visit.
It's much closer than going all the way to Perth. It's a long way. We get lots of support.
Yeah.
You need it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm clapping you. Thank you.